Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Glenn Ford returns with part two of a fine talk I call Russia, China, and the Crisis of the U.S. Ruling Class. I hope you'll stay tuned. Glenn Ford is founding editor of Black Agenda Report. When he spoke in Hartford, though, on May 17, 2017, he didn't mention race at all. Not until well into the question and answer session. Here his focus was on U.S. geostrategic policy. We heard part one last week. Let me briefly summarize his main points. The U.S. ruling class is having a crisis. To continue to dominate the world, they need to halt China's growing influence in the world. Starving China of oil would retard China nicely. That's why the U.S. launched the Iraq War in 2003, followed by the wars in Libya and now Syria. But the Iraq War disaster was a major setback. The worst part of the Iraq fiasco was that it destroyed U.S. public support for massive U.S. military presence in the Middle East. So, in desperation, the ruling U.S. imperialists have now recruited radical jihadist troops to be its mercenaries in Libya and Syria. As you might expect, this strategy is not working very well. And Russia, too, is preventing the U.S. from conquering Syria. That's one cause of the current anti-Russian hysteria that the ruling class has been fomenting. But while Russia is a nuisance to them, the real threat to the U.S. rulers' power and wealth is China. Since 2003, the rulers' strategy to contain China has failed. And the rulers know that time to do so is running out. Glenn Ford began developing these themes in the first part of his talk, which we heard last week. Today we'll repeat about the last minute of his talk to get us all reoriented, and then on with the remainder of the talk. And then some selections from the Q&A that followed. Here again is Glenn Ford.
That is not the real catastrophe. That's not the big loss that the U.S. suffered in Iraq. The truly catastrophic loss was the loss of the use of the United States Army itself. In Iraq, the United States lost the permission of the people. I'm talking about the American public. To deploy its huge land forces in the Middle East. That became not an option anymore. So here we had the most advanced, the most expensive, the most dangerous killing machine on the planet, but they could no longer use it to subdue and occupy a defeated third world country. Talk about being neutralized. This was a tremendous political defeat, which resulted in the partial neutralization of the U.S. land force, that is, the big units of the U.S. military. When the Bush presidency finally ended, the U.S., in short, was in much worse shape in terms of its imperial ambitions than when it began. It had not accomplished its mission, and yet its objective situation vis-a-vis its nemesis, China, and its reasserting nemesis, Russia, was worse than it had ever been. But the United States still had those same problems to contend with, and it could not use its big army. It was at that point, with the neutralization of the U.S. land forces as an occupation force, that the U.S. made the decision that Islamic jihadists would become the foot soldiers of empire, and that the old mission, the one they had tried to accomplish in 2003, would continue, but with a very different set of soldiers. It would continue with jihadists as U.S. soldiers. Their experience with jihadists had already taken place back in Afghanistan decades before. And there are similarities here as to why the United States felt compelled to deal with jihadists in Afghanistan. The U.S. intervened when leftists, mostly military folks, in Afghanistan overthrew the king. The United States had no capability of putting its own forces in Afghanistan, and so instead it found ways to send arms and money and such to landowners who were resisting land reform, to Islamic clergy who were allied with the landowners, and to warlords in Afghanistan. And they formed a partnership with Saudi Arabia and with Pakistan. In Pakistan, an Islamist general, Zia al-Haq, had seized power. He's the one who hanged Bhutto's father. And these three created, with the use of billions of dollars, something that had never existed in the history of the world, and that is an international jihadist network. Now, there have always been jihadists, as long as there have been Muslims, just as there were Christian jihadists as long as there has been Christianity. But never on the face of the earth had there been an international jihadist network. That was pulled together in the late 70s and in the 80s by the United States and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And the United States certainly kept the rudiments of that operation going, and the Saudi Arabians, of course, since their business is Wahhabism and their legitimacy in their world revolves around Wahhabism, continued to spend millions of dollars doing the political work of jihad, that is, funding madrasas all over the world with billions of dollars and thereby creating the troops for jihad. When the catastrophe for the United States occurs and they are denied the use of the world's most expensive and effective killing machine, Barack Obama had a choice to either abandon the project of finding ways to coerce and strangle China, which, as far as the ruling class was concerned, was an existential mission, or to use those troops that were at hand. And the troops that were at hand from that region were jihadists. Immediately, he activated them in Libya. To give you an example, there was an al-Qaeda operative whose name is Belhaj. He was arrested by the CIA in Thailand in, I think, around 2005, and then renditioned to Colonel Gaddafi in Libya. Colonel Gaddafi put him in prison, and then a couple of years before the 2011 attacks, he set Belhaj free, along with other jihadists, as part of an amnesty. Many of you may remember that according to U.S. reports, when surveys were done of jihadists who were affiliated with al-Qaeda in Iraq, the highest proportion of jihadists in the world came from Libya, specifically from the region around Benghazi. Anyway, by the time that Gaddafi was killed, this Belhaj, who'd been arrested by the CIA, rendered to Gaddafi, and then freed by Gaddafi in an amnesty, was the military commander for the so-called rebels in Tripoli, the capital of Libya. The United States and NATO became the air force of al-Qaeda in Libya. They provided the close air support that the troops, the al-Qaeda, the jihadist troops on the ground found absolutely necessary, or they could not have overcome the government in Libya. And the United States then immediately pivoted to Syria to see if they could do the exact same thing. And the U.S. corporate media pretended that they did not recognize these people as jihadists. Jihadists do not hide themselves. They are proselytizers. They not only preach, they cut off heads in order to, for demonstration effect. It's impossible that they were hidden. But the U.S. corporate media did not want to engage in the unspeakable. So now let's go to the present. Russia has prevented the U.S.-backed jihadists from overthrowing the Syrian government. ISIS, the Islamic State, has broken with al-Qaeda, which actually vastly complicates the U.S. mission in Syria, the mission for regime change, because now they have two identities of jihadists. They have a huge pool of soldiers who are in ISIS that they want to preserve because, well, they're kind of fungible. Maybe we can get them to a jihadist outfit that does not have such a bad reputation. And so the United States carries out operations that are designed primarily to kill the leaders of ISIS while not inflicting heavy casualties on ISIS troops. It carries out operations around Mosul, for example, that appear over and over again, designed to allow bodies of ISIS soldiers to escape so that they can regroup and come into conflict with the Syrian government while continuing to try to pick off the leadership of ISIS, which is a kind of way of disciplining your rogue jihadists. So the U.S. is still all in with continuing this battle with jihadists as the foot soldiers. And the reason that it's all in is not because these U.S. war planners are evil, although they are absolutely evil. They are doing this because there is nothing else available to them in terms of getting sufficient manpower. Where is the social base in that part of the world to recruit for service into the U.S. empire? It does not exist. It actually does not exist in terms of these jihadists either. They do not believe that they are in service to the U.S. empire. They certainly do not believe that they are in service to the Saudi royals or the Jordanian king or the United Arab Emirates or the king of Morocco or the emir or whatever he is of Qatar. Those folks are also ideological enemies of these jihadists. And so what we see here is that the United States, in trying to fill the void that its loss of the use of its army has created to fill the void with jihadists, has actually created more and more potent enemies for the vital allies that it has aligned itself with in the Middle East. So the contradictions become not just more acute, but they overlap and become insoluble. So here we have Donald Trump in the last election, and he threatens to pull the plug on regime change, this consensus position of the ruling class. He questions whether the United States should be refusing to cooperate with Russia. This also is a pillar of the ruling class's consensus foreign policy. And it doesn't really matter whether Trump meant what he said or what he meant when he said it or whether he even remembers that he said it. What is important here is that the very saying of it by a major candidate for president, the very saying of it panicked these folks because their mission is not only considered by them to be vital for the survival of capitalism, they know damn well that this mission is not going well. And it also is a mission that is unspeakable. And you can't have a Trump out there injecting this kind of conversation into a free-for-all presidential election debate. It is far too dangerous. So they got scared, and they ran into Hillary's big tent, and they came up with a new consensus, which was that we got to stop this Trump. We have to stop this conversation. We have to go beyond just stopping the conversation that flows from what Trump said, but we have to put a check on all of the political conversations that are occurring in the United States. And they came up with this fake news concept. Well, it's like a thief is always patting for his wallet, because thieves go for other people's wallets. They think everybody's just like them. And so since they are engaged in the biggest lie ever told, and the most sustained one, that the United States is not in alliance with Al-Qaeda, they have to put out an even bigger cover, which says that the fake news is taking over the entire conversation in the United States, which is nothing but an excuse to shut down news entirely. And so now we're at the subject, I think, of fascism, because that is really what we're talking about. One has an obligation, I suppose, if the entire conversation has been polluted by lies to the point that the integrity of the national dialogue is threatened, and that's what they're saying, somebody's got to stamp out that pollution. And that can only be some kind of fascism. And so we find ourselves in another strange and unprecedented time. Just like none of us have experienced the intensity of this anti-Russian obsession, I don't think that in the American experience we have witnessed such a profusion of talk about fascism, or at least a repeating of the word fascism. Now, we don't have a dialogue, a real conversation about what fascism is, but we hear the term every day in corporate media as part of the political conversation in ways that I do not remember it being used. In my experience, the people who used the term fascist were all leftists. And those who were not leftists didn't use the term. And when you think about it, even during that World War II period, which some folks referred to as the Great War Against Fascism, if you look at the popular media of the time, Humphrey Bogart and the rest of them aren't talking much about fascism. They're not using that word. The words that Americans used were Nazis and Japs. Obviously, the people who used the word Japs were thinking about this conflict in quite racial terms. And those who talked about Nazis were referring to a kind of folk who dressed in a certain way and heiled in a certain way. But that was not a description that we would recognize as fascism. So I don't think there's been any time in which fascism or fascist has been part of the general conversation. But we're hearing it now. And I think that is telling, that they are throwing, and this has come from the corporate media, that they are throwing around the F word, the kind of word that calls forth action without deep discussion, the kind that calls for a smashing of somebody because they're ready to smash some somebodies. And I think many of the somebodies here in this room. So these are strange times. They're strange because the ruling class is acting strange. They're acting in ways that I have never seen them act. They're acting strange because they're feeling quite vulnerable. And they feel vulnerable because they're right. They are in an existential kind of crisis. And they have failed for the last 14 years, from 2003 till now, to put up the kind of defense against the normal growth and integration of the Chinese neighborhood of the world that could save them from being thrown into the dustbin of history. When they contemplate a world in which they are not the masters, Well, that's unspeakable and unthinkable, and they go crazy, and they take it out on everybody. Thank you. Now, what I like, if we're going to have Q&A, which I know we are, is that somebody else pick out who gets called on, because I don't want people to be mad at me.
How does North Korea fit into all of this? Is that the distraction that we're talking about today? Is that the distraction? But how's North Korea fit into all this stuff? Because it got ramped up really quick recently.
Well, North Korea fits because it's been thoroughly demonized since I was born, and that's a long time. So it's useful in that regard. But North Korea is not part of the immediate crisis, or even there is no crisis of capitalism with North Korea. Any problems with North Korea are problems the United States wants to have for demonstration effects. North Korea is not in a position to bother, mess with, affect any vital interests of the United States. The danger that North Korea may represent, you have to be perverted in mind to think of this as being dangerous, lies in the desire of Koreans to unite their country. That, of course, is a danger to U.S. foreign policy, but it's not a danger that's presented by the Kim Il, whatever his name is. It's a problem that the United States has with people wanting national self-determination, which includes the right of peoples to reconcile among themselves.
Do you think that there's any way for the people, to hold the mass media accountable for their complicity in this, or is that a lost cause? Hold the media accountable.
Yeah, I always, back when we actually did have big, massive anti-war demonstrations, I always advocated that the demonstrations stop at the Washington Post and make the New York Times the target of the demonstrations, because that is as close as you can get to talking to the ruling class. But at the same time, when you do that, you expose them as being the whores that they are, and you make them quite uncomfortable. And something good may come of that, but even if nothing good does come of it, you've made them uncomfortable, which is a good thing to do. I guess I'm saying that, no, I don't know what people, besides forming alternative media, can do to harm or pressure the corporate media outside of treating them the same way you would the targets of other big demonstrations. But we don't do big demonstrations either, do we, much anymore?
Dave? Yeah, getting back to that fixation on Russia, mm-hmm. which you began your talk, what is it about Russia? Is it just a smokescreen for China? Is China really the problem? Or is it Russia's natural gas and oil deposits? Is it Russia's support for Assad? What do we really have against Russia?
No, U.S. imperialism has no respect for anybody's sovereignty. It requires that everyone accept its exceptionalism, which means that it's above the law. And Russia, under Putin, has decided that it's not willing to accept that. That makes Russia an enemy. Anybody can become an enemy of the United States simply by standing up for their sovereign rights. That will put you on the hit list, because that is not acceptable. That's not tolerable to the hegemon. Let me put it this way. When I was a very, very young reporter in my early 20s, I noticed that the State Department types and the phony journalists who acted as if they were experts in geopolitical matters were always calling these places that I'd never heard of in the world geostrategic. Everything became strategic just because there was water running through it, or one could see a sea lane a couple of hundred miles away. It became apparent to me that every place in the world was strategic, if the United States decided that it wanted to exert influence there. And then the simple fact hit me. For the empire, every place is strategic. And any place that does not recognize the authority of the empire becomes a battleground. And it doesn't matter whether it has energy supplies in it, large populations or small, or is just a hell of a terrible place for anybody to live. If it is a challenge to empire, that's a good place for a war. And they are liable to call it strategic in order to justify why there is going to be a war. But it's all based upon who bows down to empire. There is no objective reason. It's not about, look, there is no country in the world that does not want to produce oil for the market. There has never been a problem of people withholding oil, except for a political demonstration in 1973. But otherwise, it's in everybody's interest, if they're going to develop their oil, to put it out there in the world market. The United States talks about guaranteeing the free flow of oil or the free flow of commerce, when in fact there's nobody threatening the free flow of oil or commerce or anything else except the United States. We can't buy into these arguments that have no basis in actually the way the world works just because the United States says them, or because the New York Times repeats them.
Can you talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and what it really meant and what it means that Trump killed it?
Yeah, before Trump killed it, it appears to have been dead, which is very good because that means we don't owe Trump. You know what I mean? The good deed was done. But I think you guys know what TPP was. I'd like to do just a little angle on TPP because people have been talking about the deep state. That's another term now that's in common usage. And some people do argue about what that means. I think the deep state is quite easy to see and not that deep at all. But anyway, I read that there were several hundred lobbyists and other designated hit people for corporations who took part in putting TPP together over about 10 years. Those people had not just total access to the document, but they wrote the document. These are all private people. And yet, congressmen and senators could not see the TPP document. And later on, when certain members of Congress were allowed to see it, they couldn't even take notes. So here we have hundreds of corporate representatives who are not just seeing this document, but actually writing it, and the elected representatives of the United States government can't even see it. Now, where is the deep state? Obviously, those hundreds of people, those hundreds of corporate guys, are deep state. And obviously, the senators are not.
Glenn Ford from his May 17 talk in Hartford, Connecticut. The talk was sponsored by WWUH-FM Public Affairs Department and recorded by David Schoenfeld. Many thanks to all of the above. If you missed part one of Ford's talk, you can get it from our program's website. The address is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer of New World Notes. Thank you for listening. Illegitimate non carborundum. Remember that you are not alone. Please come back again next week, and happy trails to you till we meet again.